We are leaving the world of known physics today and plunging straight into a secret history file. This is a document that reads less like classified research and more like the grim, methodical blueprint for a biological arms race. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
This is a remarkable deep dive because it pulls us away from the conventional image of the Cold War arms race.
Yeah.
You know, the missiles, the bombers, the nuclear anxiety. And it focuses instead on a far more terrifying, quiet obsession, the military's quest to genetically engineer the ultimate soldier.
We're talking about the late 1950s, a period of, well, profound technological ambition. Yet this story centers entirely on biological engineering. It's a classified military attempt to fundamentally rewrite the human sensory system for the battlefield, pursuing a goal the documents refer to simply as biological superiority.
And the files we have processed reveal the sheer desperation that drove this program, alongside the terrifyingly high cost of the research. This is not just a technological story, it is a neurological one. It details a biological system that, once created, quickly proved to be beyond the control of its own creators.
So our mission today is to process a heavily redacted file detailing a program established in the absolute isolation of White Sands, New Mexico. It was focused entirely, ruthlessly, on enhancing human perception. We need to understand the initial objective, the almost unfathomable failure rate inherent in the methodology, the single fragile success they achieved, and the chilling, profound implications of what happened when that success, that biological creation, walked away.
And that's the key, isn't it? This file doesn't detail a failed experiment. Far from it. It's about apparatus designed to contain it.
A system built into a person.
Exactly. We are looking at a timeline where the military traded traditional ethical constraints for potential utility, aiming to create an early warning system that was not merely attached to the soldier, but fundamentally built into the soldier's nervous system.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting not with the subject, but with the specific, singular objective that drove this entire program. We begin our investigation in the early to mid-1950s, located deep within the vast classified expanse of White Sands, New Mexico. As you know, White Sands is already a location synonymous with weapons testing, high security, remote operations.
It's the perfect place to hide something.
It's geographically perfect for concealing projects that the Pentagon would prefer never saw the light of day. But while, you know, the newspapers were focused on the rockets and the ballistic missile tests that defined the era, something far more invasive was happening behind closed doors.
And the location's isolation was not a coincidence at all. It provided not only logistical security, but the administrative cover necessary for, well, for morally questionable research. The singular driving focus of this entire White Sands operation was enhancing human perception on the battlefield.
That phrase alone is, it's a lot.
It is. And if you think about the tactical landscape of the 1950s, it was rapidly becoming mechanized, but surveillance was still fallible. Radar could be jammed, acoustic sensors were clumsy, and, you know, human eyesight remained limited.
So the goal wasn't to build a better version of existing technology, was it? It was a radical leap of faith, trying to eliminate the need for those bulky, external, and often failure-prone early warning systems.
Exactly. They wanted to weaponize awareness itself. Imagine a scout who doesn't rely on binoculars, thermal imaging, or even sound, but who simply knows the enemy is present.
Wow.
This minimizes dependency on external gear, it removes the need for batteries or maintenance, and it provides instantaneous internal feedback. It shifts the entire paradigm of battlefield intelligence.
And the scientific inspiration they settled on for this radical shift is truly where the source files take a sharp, fascinating turn. When you think of keen senses, you might expect them to study the nervous systems of gnats for echolocation, maybe deep sea fish, or even apex mammalian predators like wolves.
Sure, that's the logical path.
But no, the documents explicitly state that the military scientists bypassed the mammalian world entirely. Their research focused on insects, and specifically arachnids.
Spiders.
It seems counterintuitive, perhaps even cartoonish, until you analyze the specific sensory mechanisms of arthropods, which rely heavily on non-visual and non-auditory data.
Right, and arachnids, particularly spiders and scorpions, are evolutionary masters of detecting the environment through mechanisms that are entirely inaccessible to the unaugmented human, namely mechanoreception.
Mechanoreception. Can you break that down?
It's sensing the world through physical forces. Vibrations, pressure, tension. The military wasn't aiming for better conventional senses. They were aiming to graft an entirely different class of awareness onto human biology.
This becomes clear when you look at the three key sensory abilities they were focused on replicating. These weren't general goals. they were hyper-specific tactical advantages. The first target ability was sensing vibrations.
And that capability profoundly changes the nature of infantry combat, particularly in urban environments or heavily fortified defensive positions. For an arachnid, sensing vibrations through the web or through the ground via specialized sensory hairs is how they locate prey and avoid predators.
So for a soldier, this translates to knowing if someone is approaching you through the ground, through a concrete floor, or through the supporting structure of a building you occupy.
Yes, exactly.
The vibration is the key, isn't it? It means a soldier senses the subtle seismic waves of an approaching footstep through dense earth or concrete long before any sound wave reaches them through the air. You're talking about precognitive awareness of position.
Precisely. If we quantify that, the difference in transmission speed of a kinetic wave through a solid medium like concrete versus a sound wave through air is significant. It's not even close.
So by the time you hear something...
By the time an enemy is close enough for the sound of their footstep to register via air, the kinetic vibration through the structure has already traveled much further and been registered by the subject's entire body. They're already reacting, already aiming, potentially already moving to cover.
That's a huge advantage. The second ability they targeted was the ability to sense changes in air pressure. This is a subtle yet incredibly powerful form of stealth detection.
Air pressure sensing implies detection of minute air displacement caused by movement. Think about a person creeping slowly through a dense fog, obscured by smoke, or simply moving in absolute darkness.
They're invisible.
Visually, yes, but their body still displaces a volume of air. Arachnids use specialized slit sensilla to detect these minute displacements. Grafting this onto a human means the soldier transforms into a hypersensitive barometer of immediate kinetic motion.
So if you combine vibration sensing through solids and pressure sensing through gases, you suddenly have a complete three-dimensional picture of kinetic activity in the immediate vicinity.
And it doesn't matter if you can see it or not.
It's independent of line of sight or visual obfuscation.
It creates a fully integrated biological perimeter defense system. It negates the advantage of darkness, heavy cover, or even specialized stealth tactics. The moment an enemy moves, even just shifting their weight, they alter the pressure and vibration field around them, and the subject instantly registers that input. It makes concealment practically impossible.
And the third objective was the synthesis of the first two. Detecting movement long before visual contact was made. This is the metric of success. This is what it was all for.
That's the ultimate goal of the entire Cold War military complex, isn't it? Early warning.
Yeah.
But instead of relying on enormous fragile radar dishes or complex sensor arrays, the military sought an early warning system built directly into the soldier's nervous system, offering instant integrated feedback.
So you're not reacting to a threat after it's perceived.
You are anticipating and acting before the threat is fully materialized. You possess the decisive tactical advantage of preemption.
The source material suggests a profound leap of faith here, that the sheer tactical utility of these abilities was worth the massive, unprecedented biological risk. I mean, they were essentially attempting the ultimate evolutionary shortcut.
Grafting millions of years of spider survival mechanisms onto the incredibly complex, finely tuned human nervous system.
It sounds like science fiction.
And that desperation, that Cold War drive for biological advantage, is what allowed them to bypass all conventional scientific caution. They weren't tinkering. They were attempting to rebuild fundamental human hardware. The question then immediately becomes, how did they attempt this radical interphylum graft?
And this takes us directly into Act Two, the methodology. And this is where the files become intensely clinical, detailing both the ambition of the goal and the sheer brutality of the process.
It is essential to understand the technical boundary they set for themselves. The files were explicit. The goal was not aimed at visible mutation.
Right. They weren't trying to create a monster from a movie. No eight eyes, no extra limbs.
No. They weren't trying to create a soldier with eight eyes or dermal hairs capable of independent movement. The operational success depended entirely on the subject remaining outwardly, structurally human.
Which means the target was entirely internal and microscopic. They were aiming for genetic fusion at the cellular level. To rewrite the nervous system, they had to alter the fundamental coding, attempting to merge the operational blueprint of human cells with the sensory mechanisms derived from arachnid biology.
This is the critical, complex detail. In the 1950s, our understanding of genetics and cellular engineering was rudimentary at best.
You're basically flying blind.
Completely. The idea of introducing genetic material from an entirely different phylum, say, inserting code responsible for specialized mechanoreceptors into the human domus and central nervous system, was breathtakingly reckless. They weren't just hoping for compatibility, they were banking on a genetic miracle.
Did the files say how they were trying to do this? Like, what was the mechanism for fusion? Were they talking about viral vectors or some other method of cellular integration?
The documents don't specify the exact delivery agent, likely due to security redaction, but the outcome they sought strongly implies they were targeting the integration of non-human genetic instructions into neural and perhaps specialized dermal cells.
So they weren't replacing cells?
No, the aim wasn't to replace human cells, but to reprogram them. To install the arachnid sensory software onto the human body's hardware. This process itself, attempting to alter a functioning adult nervous system, is fundamentally destabilizing.
And the sources provide the key term for the intended internal restructuring. They aim to achieve a distributed sensory response.
Let's spend some time unpacking that specific phrase for you, because it's really the scientific core of the entire project.
Think about normal human perception. It's highly centralized. We have specialized, localized organs, eyes, ears, tongue. A distributed sensory response drawn directly from the arachnid model means that the entire surface of the body, and perhaps the underlying skeletal and muscular structure, would function as a uniform receptor.
So the skin isn't just touch sensitive anymore, it's an integrated sensor array. Precisely. We know that spiders use sensory hairs and slits to detect vibrations across their body, instantly locating the source. For the subject, the skin, hair follicles, and even the periosteum, that's the membrane covering bone, might have been rewired to pick up minute variations in vibration, air pressure, and perhaps even subtle thermal shifts.
And feeding that data back to the central nervous system instantaneously.
Yes. The subject becomes a giant walking antenna with sensory input spread across the entire body, turning every inch of their flesh into a hyper-tuned kinetic sensor.
This complexity explains the staggering failure rate. You're attempting to essentially hotwire a sophisticated system with foreign components. The likelihood of catastrophic rejection must have been nearly 100%.
It was. The sources state bluntly, dozens of trials failed. This was a long, protracted, and brutally sacrificial process. It wasn't just a matter of incompatibility, it was a repeated shattering of the human neurological system.
And the resulting failures, detailed in the clinical logs, paint a horrific picture of the cost. We have logs detailing three critical destructive outcomes. Let's start with the first, severe seizures.
Seizures are the body's manifestation of massive neurological short-circuiting. If you introduce a new massive flood of sensory data into a brain not designed to receive or process it, or if the attempted cellular fusion leads to localized areas of extreme electrical excitability, the brain experiences an intolerable overload.
It just breaks.
The result is uncontrolled, violent electrical discharge. This speaks to immediate, profound neurological trauma. These weren't mild episodes. They indicate the immediate, fundamental rejection of the attempted restructuring.
So the attempts to graft these new sensory pathways were essentially frying the subject's existing biological circuit board.
And if they survived the initial trauma, the next failure mode was often psychosis. This is perhaps even more disturbing because it implies a successful or partially successful biological integration that the cognitive mind simply could not handle.
I can't even begin to imagine the level of mental instability that results when the brain is suddenly flooded with data it cannot filter. If your body is registering every pressure change, every vibration from traffic a mile away, every slight shift in air movement, it must be an overwhelming, constant roar of information.
That is the neurological reality of psychosis in this context. The human brain relies on complex filtering mechanisms to maintain sanity, discarding extraneous noise and data. When you introduce a distributed sensory response, those filtering mechanisms are likely disabled or overwhelmed.
The cognitive load shatters the mind.
The subject is trapped in a constant, overwhelming cacophony, a world that is too loud, too busy, too physically present. As one of the early researchers may have noted in the non-redacted portion of a secondary file, there is no quiet place to hide inside their own minds.
That phrase, wow. That single observation captures the tragic failure of the research better than any technical description. They succeeded in changing the biology, but destroyed the capacity of the person to live within that change.
And then we reach the third, most terrifying consequence described in the logs. Total sensory collapse. This suggests a failure mode far beyond overload or misfiring.
What does total sensory collapse imply biologically? Is this a permanent state of neural silence, like being trapped in your own body?
Based on the terminology, yes. It suggests that the attempt to rewrite the sensory system specifically targeting the cellular level went too far. Instead of failing to integrate the new system, it successfully destroyed the original existing sensory pathways, while the new fused pathways failed to become fully operational or functional.
So they're left with nothing.
The subject would be neurologically dark, unable to see, hear, taste, or feel, trapped entirely within a non-responsive, non-aware body. It's the ultimate price of improperly rewriting the sensory system, leaving the subject entirely isolated in a void.
The clinical coldness of these logs, detailing dozens of seizures, psychosis, and total collapses, it underscores the ethical indifference that the Cold War drive fostered. They were willing to sacrifice dozens of human lives to accept these destructive, permanent outcomes in the pursuit of a single successful prototype.
And that willingness to burn through resources, both human and financial, ultimately paid off for them, at least temporarily, because after all that sacrifice, they did achieve the impossible.
This brings us to Act 3, the success.
The file confirms the extreme rarity of the breakthrough. Only one test succeeded. This means that out of dozens of attempts, one specific subject possessed the precise, unlikely biological compatibility to allow the cellular integration to take root without immediate total neurological rejection.
And crucially, the subject remained outwardly human. The success was stealthy. There were no visible cinematic mutations. This was the exact operational goal, a perfect biological asset, entirely undetectable by appearance alone. The change was mapped entirely within his new nervous system.
Let's delve deep into the documented changes, because this is where the files shift from cataloging failure to detailing breathtaking new abilities. The descriptions in the military logs move far beyond simply keen senses and into genuine precognition.
The most telling and frightening phrases revolve around his demonstrated capability for preemptive avoidance. This doesn't mean he was quick to dodge. It means he avoided danger before it occurred.
This is the definitive proof that the fusion succeeded in creating a neurological feedback loop that bypasses typical conscious awareness. If the distributed sensory response is feeding immediate, unfiltered kinetic data to the deeper, older reflex centers of the brainstem and spinal cord,
the body just moves on its own.
The body can initiate evasive action faster than the visual cortex can process the threat.
So a normal human sees the flash, processes the threat, and then initiates the movement to dodge. This subject, he senses the minute air pressure change created by the muzzle flash, or perhaps the vibration of the weapon cycling, and is already moving to cover milliseconds before the conscious brain even registers the bang.
Exactly. He wasn't avoiding the bullet. He was avoiding the moment the shooter committed to the action. This shifts the subject from being merely reactive to being fundamentally predictive, a biological mechanism designed for survival through anticipation. This capability is unprecedented in non-augmented human biology.
The logs also detail his profound ability for motion detection, unseen. He reacted, consistently and accurately, to movement he could not see.
This confirms the total success of the arachnid sensory model transfer. Whether it was in pitch blackness, behind thick visual barriers, or masked by complex environments, he was registering kinetic activity purely based on subtle air pressure disturbances and localized structural vibrations.
So standard military concealment and camouflage are useless against it.
Totally useless. For the military, the battlefield suddenly became entirely transparent to the single individual.
But the true tactical nightmare for any opposing force, and eventually for his handlers, was the ability known as structural sensing. The documented capacity to detect movement through walls, floors, and structures. This moves beyond simple hearing and into a true biological X-ray vision based on kinetic transmission.
If we consider the physics involved here, solid materials like concrete, steel, and wood are extremely efficient at transmitting sonic and kinetic energy. Our normal human nervous system is bombarded by this data constantly, but our brains are masters at filtering it out as irrelevant noise.
But his new distributed nervous system was interpreting those minute shifts. The bending of a floorboard under weight, the slight compression of a concrete wall when leaned upon, as actionable high-fidelity data.
He could stand outside a secure facility, place a hand on the wall, and effectively map the internal architecture, locate occupants, and track their steps simply by processing the kinetic energy transmitting through the structure.
That's incredible.
Think about the strategic implications. You can hide behind reinforced concrete, but you cannot hide your physical presence or movement from him. He is constantly receiving an early warning signal filtered through the structure itself.
The military logs synthesize this entire suite of abilities, comparing it to arachnid threat awareness. They characterize the fusion's output as a true sixth sense, an immediate internal early warning system built permanently into the body itself.
This is where we see the transition from subject to asset. The operational implications are staggering. This soldier doesn't need to judge, doesn't need to analyze sensor readouts, and doesn't need external intelligence. He relies on biological certainty. His body knows when danger is imminent, instantly.
So in the context of the Cold War, this single individual was the biological equivalent of a localized, indestructible, unjammable radar system, a profound advantage over any known technology of the era.
The success was undeniable, unprecedented.
And based on the records, it immediately led to an administrative fever pitch to weaponize him. Here's where it gets really interesting and tragically predictable. The immediate military reaction to this success was not careful study, but intense, accelerated escalation.
The moment the Army realized the sheer game-changing potential of this subject, the testing regimen was transformed. They had invested dozens of lives and untold resources, and now they had their prototype. The objective shifted from understanding the subject's biology to pushing him to the absolute practical limit.
The escalation was inevitable, but it was also fundamentally destructive. They needed to find the failure point of the system, and they chose the most brutal methods designed to erode the human element while assessing the durability of the enhanced senses.
The logs detail three primary methods used to push the subject to the limit. The first was the relentless use of sleep deprivation.
Sleep deprivation is cruel in any context, but for a subject possessing a distributed sensory response, it's a form of perpetual psychological torture, isn't it?
Absolutely. When a normal person sleeps, the brain actively filters and processes the sensory data gathered during the day, achieving neurological regulation. For a subject whose entire body is now a hypersensitive sensor array, a lack of sleep means his brain has zero downtime.
No off switch.
None. The constant input, the low hum of the environment, the structural vibrations of the distant ventilation, the microscopic pressure changes of the air conditioner would become amplified and unfiltered 24 hours a day.
It could never truly rest. The world was simply too loud, too busy, too physically present, even in the most secure facility. They were attempting to determine if the sensory system could function at peak output 247, but the result would only amplify the existing sensory overload, pushing him rapidly toward the psychosis that claimed the other subjects.
Second, they implemented intense stress exposure. This involved prolonged periods of uncertainty, isolation, and constant psychological pressure, often involving false alarms or threats he could sense but couldn't verify.
Given that he already had a hyperreactive nervous system designed for preemptive avoidance, constant stress would have been intended to test whether the sixth sense would maintain tactical clarity or simply overload and collapse under the continuous flood of threat data.
They needed to see if the subject could manage that constant flow of input, if he could distinguish an actual threat from irrelevant environmental noise under pressure. Stress exposure, especially when combined with total exhaustion, is designed to shatter the existing personality and force the enhanced biological mechanisms to dominate,
making the man a purely reactive tool.
Exactly. They were, perhaps inadvertently, attempting to refine the soldier by destroying the man.
And finally, the ultimate test? Live fire exercises. He was forced to survive real immediate danger, relying solely on his new enhanced senses to achieve preemptive avoidance.
And this is where the fragility of the entire experiment manifested. While tactically necessary from the military's viewpoint, the consequence of this relentless, overwhelming stress was inevitable. The files state clearly that the intense testing caused the subject to become unstable.
A nervous system constantly receiving an avalanche of new, chaotic, and often threatening data, combined with zero regulatory downtime, cannot remain psychologically intact. The success was profoundly fragile.
It was. The researchers had perfected the input mechanism, the distributed sensor, but failed entirely to provide the subject with a biological off switch or the cognitive framework needed to cope with perpetual, unfiltered awareness.
And this inherent instability led directly to the critical event, the escape in late 1959. The file specifies that the subject escaped during a transfer operation.
That is a small but incredibly important detail. It means he didn't rely on brute force or external help. A transfer operation is precisely the moment of maximum vulnerability in any high-security operation. A change of location, a shift in personnel, a brief exposure outside the secure confines of the lab or housing unit.
and a subject with his unique ability to sense his environment, his guards, and their intentions long before they were conscious of his awareness, would have seen that moment of operational slack coming.
He didn't have to wait for a guard to open a door. He could sense the slight pressure shift in the guard's stance, the minor tremor of the vehicle arriving, or the localized stress on the floorboards as the escort team approached their position. He exploited a tactical movement phase, not a security failure of a fixed structure.
The military response was immediate, unprecedented, and vast. The search effort rapidly escalated beyond the White Sands facility, requiring a nationwide expansion.
This was far beyond a localized manhunt. The sheer scale confirms the gravity of the success. They had created an asset so unique, so powerful, that its escape was deemed an immediate multi-state security threat.
The logs specify establishing roadblocks and demanding military coordination across multiple states. They feared his knowledge, his capability, and his unique ability to evade capture.
He wasn't just a security risk because he knew secrets. He was a security risk because he was biologically designed to detect pursuit before it could engage him.
And the final undeniable result of that massive coordinated effort.
The man was never recovered.
Never. The search eventually failed, leading to the inevitable administrative consequence. The program was shut down and erased.
The entire White Sands project vanished into the classified archives, becoming one of those phantom programs that only exist in fragments. The erasure is almost as telling as the details themselves.
How so?
It is the classic pattern of black operations. The unrecoverable loss of the asset, combined with the widespread security breach, necessitates total administrative deletion. This thematic parallel runs through many files from that era. The deletion of the operational record becomes the primary evidence of the program's existence and its profound failure to control its own creation.
Like the case of Klaus Richter.
Exactly. Like Klaus Richter, erasure becomes the definitive evidence. The efforts to scrub the program suggest they knew the subject's capabilities were permanent, successful, and now irrevocably loose in the civilian world.
And the researchers, the military commanders who authorized and oversaw this relentless pursuit, eventually had to confront the terrible, profound irony of their failure.
The file ends abruptly. It details the program's erasure, the massive cost of the failed search, and then a single, cryptic, final sentence that encapsulates the futility of the entire endeavor.
It's the moment the hunter realized they had designed an uncatchable creature and that they themselves were now the vulnerable ones.
We've tracked the entire journey. The 1950s pursuit of arachnid fusion, the catastrophic cost of the failures, the single fragile creation of the preemptive soldier, and his definitive, uncatchable escape across state lines. The search was vast, coordinated, and failed utterly.
Here's the exact quote from the source material, the final line written in the file before it was sealed. It's a declaration of surrender disguised as an administrative footnote. The subject no longer needs to be observed. He already knows when we are near.
That sentence. It's a stunning declaration of mission failure through oversuccess. It confirms, first and foremost, the permanence of the alteration. The subject's enhanced perception was not degrading under stress, but was fully operational.
But the real weight of that sentence.
The true weight of that sentence lies in the second implication. His enhanced perception includes his pursuers.
Every method they employed to track him, every foot patrol, every surveillance vehicle, every agent staking out a known location was sensed by him long before they could achieve visual confirmation or even auditory detection.
If he can detect structural movement through floors and the most subtle shifts in air pressure, then the approach of a convoy hundreds of yards away or the minute kinetic vibrations caused by an operative slowly creeping through dense terrain would be instantly registered by his distributed sensory system.
The entire apparatus of military tracking became instantly obsolete the moment they were designated as pursuers.
They created a master of avoidance and then became the danger he needed to avoid.
It's an implied declaration that the chase is over, not because of exhaustion or a change in mandate, but because the subject proved definitively uncatchable. They created an agent who could not be observed because he possessed the superior capability of observing his observers first.
The White Sand soldier who could sense you through walls, the first human with a biological early warning system, successfully dissolved into the population, defined entirely by his ability to remain unseen because he sees all attempts to find him.
This leaves us with a final lingering provocative thought for you, the listener. If this subject truly avoids danger before it occurs, if he can detect every approaching footstep, every pressure change, and every human intention within his immediate vicinity, How would such an individual carrying the knowledge of military secrets and profound biological alteration ever choose to interact with the world again?
Right.
What does life look like when you are cursed with perpetual unfiltered awareness? Is that constant, immediate, and unavoidable knowledge a superpower? Or is it a perpetual, unmanageable prison of sensory information?
A life where you know always that someone is near, watching, or approaching. It's the ultimate terrifying form of isolation.
Thank you for diving deep with us into the Classified Files of White Sands full breakdown. The file index and the original source materials are available now exclusively for members. Find the Inspector Story series file and more at Ed Inspector Story. Thank you for diving deep with us.